On this week's program, we take a look at the Philadelphia Orchestra's finances in an exclusive interview with CEO Allison Volgamore and CFO Mario Masticelli. Susan Lewis explores the Philadelphia Museum of Art summer show, examining the late works of Auguste Renoir. And Tom Keels takes us to Philadelphia on Stone, an exhibition at the Library Company of Philadelphia, exploring how local lithographers have depicted their city from the 1800s to the present day. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The past couple of years have been tough for the Philadelphia Orchestra. Even prior to the recession, the organization had gone through a tumultuous period of change. Its president and CEO, Jim Undercuffler, oversaw the departure of music director Christoph Eschenbach. Undercuffler himself resigned before the end of his term. Board chair Hal Sargenti also retired. So by January 2009, the Philadelphia Orchestra was without a chairman, a president, or a music director and facing some serious financial shortfalls. Concert attendances were down, and at one point there was even talk of bankruptcy. 18 months later, things are looking up. Board Chair Richard Worley has overseen the hiring of a new president, Allison Volgamore, and she in turn was part of the selection of Yannick Nezet-Séguin as the orchestra's eighth music director. 3 months ago, the orchestra was facing a nearly $3 million deficit, but now expects to end its fiscal year with a balanced budget, due in large part to solicited donations to a special fund created to bridge the budget gap. It also received contributions in cash and kind from its musicians and made cutbacks in staff and salaries. But there's still work to be done to solve the orchestra's financial woes. Although there have been recent increases in ticket sales, some performances last season saw barely two-thirds of the seats in Verizon Hall filled. The orchestra is also trying to raise a further $10 million for its bridge-slash-recovery fund, suggesting further budget deficits in coming years. I spoke with Orchestra President Allison Volgamore and Chief Financial Officer Mario Masticelli earlier this week. When you arrived here, I asked how you thought things were at the orchestra, and you said wonderful, and I had a slight sense of it being somewhat whistling past the graveyard. The atmosphere then was not good. Has it improved?
I'm honored to be a part of an experience that I'm having with the Philadelphia Orchestra that I think is shared. We're getting to know each other. The silos are going down. There's still important debate internally about perhaps why the Philadelphia Orchestra is facing these kinds of big change moves. But frankly, there's a lot of excitement that we have a leadership team in place. We have a strong senior staff that's committed. And when you look at the musicians' own contributions for this year, their board's contributions above the annual fund, that's the best signal we can give ourselves and our public that we're in charge of our learning to make this be a long-term, wonderful organization for Philadelphia.
And having cemented the leadership, I'm guessing that makes the organization much more attractive to potential donors.
Well, I think it answers open questions. And I think Yannick has a tremendous talent. People are aware all of his dance card is full. He's in Salzburg right now with the Vienna Philharmonic. I'm Skyping with him this weekend on strategic planning, going to see him in a month. So, sure, it is reassuring to know that the future of the artistic health of the orchestra is set for at least 7 years between Charles Dutoit, then becoming conductor laureate in 12, and Yannick already being here and a part of the planning as music director designate. That's invigorating.
Mario, what do you anticipate the financial year 2010 operating budget actual results will look like?
I think that there's been an extraordinary improvement over our initial working budget. It's my expectation that we'll end the year either at a balanced position or a slight surplus, depending on how the activity of the recovery fund goes for the remainder of the year.
The target for that was $15 million. How's it going?
It's going well. When we go through the details, you'll see that we've recorded already through June $6.7 million. And this is cash that we've received or irrevocable pledges and commitments that we've received. We've also had quite a bit more in terms of verbal commitments that haven't been reflected. We haven't recorded those yet until we get the appropriate accounting background for it. But I'm very, very optimistic that we'll achieve those goals. And it's bridged that gap for us for fiscal year 10 in a way that I'm very pleased with.
What would the deficit have been without the bridge funding?
Well, the original working budget had a $7.8 million deficit. And the vast majority of that has been offset by the recovery fund thus far, plus about $1 million to $1.1 million of positive variances in both earned revenue And positive variances and expense reductions as well. So I think it's a contribution from all of the constituencies.
So in English, it would have been 7.8 million.
That's correct. I'm sorry.
Okay, sorry. It's okay. I'm not an accountant.
Zero sounds a lot better.
Zero does sound a lot better. Let me turn to you, Alison. Have you, I presume you're now in the process of discussing FY 2011's budget. What does that look like?
Here's what we know. We know it took significant personal contributions from musician and staff and board to close this deficit this year to zero. We also know that that is an annual deficit reduction, and we're yet to tackle the structural. But what we're learning by closing that deficit is going to influence what we know we have to do for 11. So we're going to need to do this all over again for 11, hence the grounding of the bridge funding going into that year in the recovery fund. I also think because we've had much more dialogue together, musicians and staff and board, our interests are piqued to be very efficient while still presenting the art. That's going to benefit us in the process of putting Fiscal 11 together. But despite our progress, we still have significant change we'll need to make through the strategic planning process.
Which takes me to your next point. Do you anticipate the board signing off on a 2011 budget that would anticipate a deficit?
Well, I'm not going to predict the board because we haven't taken them the budget yet. But I know the institutional mindset is to do everything possible always in the budgeting creation, in the budget creation, to anticipate where we can be, as I said, efficient while presenting our art. We already know that the structural deficit is significant enough that we will need all the contributions that have already been given by our musicians and staff, which are already set to continue, that floors that budget, and this significant recovery fund, which we're actually doing a stretch goal of 18 for at this point.
Do you anticipate it turning to the musicians again to look at reductions in salaries and benefits?
You know, the musicians and management agreed when we closed the last reopener that we needed to stay at the table and continue to figure out the future. And so, as I think you're aware, that reopener says that's a process we need to be in, and that will evolve over the fall.
That's the current state of play. Let me turn to you again, Mario, and to talk about the endowment. What's the value of the endowment now, and where is it in terms of the great falls that everybody's experienced?
Well, the total market value of the endowment on the POA side is about $102 million through June.
From a peak of?
Well, there was probably a peak of about, I want to say, 160 or so. At its highest point several years ago. Not only did the market dislocations have an impact on that, but our endowment spending that's withdrawn from that also had an impact on it. The other thing to keep in mind, too, is that we manage not just the orchestra, but the Academy of Music endowment as well, which is approximately $19 million through June 30th as well. So the combined value of total assets for all of the organization is about $120 million now, total market value.
And the allowed drawdown on both of those endowments as well?
In Pennsylvania, we are governed by a specific statute that restricts the draw on a trailing three-year market value average of between 2 and 7%. Not all of the pool is being drawn at the same rate because of specific restrictions that certain donors have placed on it. But historically, we've been between 5.5% and 6.5%. The most recent year will be 6.95%.
The normal reaction of any organization, of all organizations in this traumatic economic climate, is to become more efficient, cut costs. But there's also the question of improving earned revenue. Is there a plan in place to try and improve earned revenue?
We're pleased that ticket sales were better than we expected by the end of the year. We're pleased.
What percentage did you sell over the course of the season?
We ended up at about 74%.
If I were to ask you, I'm sure you would say that you would love to be at 100% capacity. What's a realistic goal moving forward?
Well, we're going to explore that in the strategic plan. There are very few orchestras, if any, if you truly drill down on their numbers, who are at 100% sold in this economic climate. But certainly the Philadelphia Orchestra has hemorrhaged people who love us and that we care about. And so we want to reconnect with those patrons as audience members and as donors very quickly with important messages of understanding we know we need to take care of our own health and there's great art here to taste.
Let me go back down to some nitty-gritty of the numbers. The two largest salary expenses. Can I ask what salary and equal be paid?
We don't release the salaries.
Okay, your salary will become a matter of public record in the coming months. Do you want to talk about that?
No. I mean, the bottom line is we invest in talent. That's one of the discussions about our staff and our musicians. So whether it's the administrator, the music director, or the priceless support of a chairman who isn't paid, and our musicians, our employees, we are an art form of people, and we do invest in that talent.
Let me turn to you again, Mario, and to talk about the financial impact of touring. Is it a loss leader, or can money be made touring?
Yes. I mean, I think that it's definitely something that will be part of our strategic planning. In all of what we do, not just with touring, but with all of our endeavors, we're focusing more on the net contribution to the bottom line, and we're looking to make sure that we balance those things with the artistic integrity of the product, whether it be an analysis of our venues, an analysis of touring. And, you know, each of these kinds of even tours, not all tours are made the same. They're all very different. So I think that what is true and what can be said about going forward is that we'll look at them more carefully than we had in the past, with an eye towards maintaining the artistic integrity and making sure that it has an appropriate contribution from a net margin standpoint.
So you'd like to see yourself making money out of it, if possible.
At least have a break-even.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And what's been the case historically? Have you had to subsidize them?
Well, in some instances, yes. As I said, not all are created equal. It depends on the venues, where we're touring, the participation from sponsors. They're all very, very different. In some instances, we've had great success. In others, not so much. But we're, like I said, we're looking at that very, very carefully. It'll be part of the strategic planning process, how touring, both locally and internationally, fits into the larger strategic plan. And we'll do it with an eye towards a contribution to the bottom line.
What would be an ideal situation for the orchestra to be in, say, in 3 years' time?
Well, I think our balancing act I've spoken to. It involves having the standard of excellence the orchestra is able to give to this community in place with a sustainable mechanism for supporting the cost of that excellence. That isn't sufficient. We also have to be strong community servants in how we're using our orchestra's talent, working with them to help design that. And also we have to be innovative. And so I'm interested in how art and media and education, how does all of that work together to create one holistic product from the Philadelphia Orchestra, and rather than separate products?
There is the possibility that we haven't seen the depths of this recession/depression yet. Is there a plan B if it gets a lot worse?
Any responsible organization has to look at both a progressive plan and a plan that keeps the organization in place. We're looking at both sides of that coin always.
What's the worst case scenario, do you think?
I don't think we have a worst case scenario we're pursuing. I think when you look at the contributions of the musicians, no Big Five orchestra has had musicians give $8 million of anticipated increases back with no restoration discussion. That's a tremendous contribution from these musicians. No Big Five orchestra has had a board give over $8 million. So what I see in that is a confidence of an institution to pursue a secure future. That's where we're focused.
Philadelphia Orchestra President Allison Volgamore and Chief Financial Officer Mario Mazzucchelli. The orchestra's annual report for the current financial year will be made public in the fall.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The great French impressionist Pierre-Auguste Renoir worked until his death in 1919 and was regarded as one of the greatest artists of his time. Although the modern art world of the mid-20th century embraced other masters, an exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, organized in partnership with museums in Paris and Los Angeles, makes the case that Renoir's work during his last three decades is among his finest and was a model for the generation that would follow. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers late Renoir.
The exhibition begins with an oil portrait of two well-dressed girls, eyes downcast, huddled outdoors around one book, reading. The painting, with its simple subject, its complex use of colors, the pale fluid strokes of the skin, the brilliant whites and orangey yellows of the dresses and hats, green and brown brushstrokes suggesting foliage, and its sunny, serene mood, sets the tone for the entire show, says Joseph Rischel, the Philadelphia Museum's curator of European painting before 1900.
It's the celebration of just contentment, beauty, serenity, and timelessness, but completely contemporary timelessness in this case.
Philadelphia Museum of Art director Timothy Rubb says during the last decades of his life, Renoir had critical success that many people today don't fully appreciate.
He was considered in the 1890s, in the first several decades of the 20th century, to be one of the great living artists and one of the most significant figures that came out of Impressionism and built upon it later in his career.
The museum's associate curator of European painting before 1900, Jennifer Thompson, says Renoir was also influencing the future of art.
All of these younger artists, such as Picasso and Matisse, Bonnard, were all very, very aware of what Renoir was doing, because he was still continuing to exhibit works in Paris and to show them additionally in New York and in Venice and elsewhere. So he was a very active figure in the art world, but was this immense, almost father figure to many of these artists.
And yet, many of the works from his late period received little scholarly attention. Mid-20th century critics didn't quite know where to place him in an age of modernism that embraced edgy, anxious works, says Rischel.
In Renoir, what you see is what you get. Perhaps it was his just forthright optimism that just got any card-carrying existentialist really cross.
This new show has, as a consequence, yielded some great discoveries, says Thompson.
They're paintings that we didn't know existed or that have been lost or hadn't been seen since the 1920s that have emerged. So there'll be several works in this exhibition that probably haven't been on public view for 70, 80 years.
This exhibition of Renoir's, interspersed with a few works of Picasso and Matisse, among others, doesn't start until 1980, by which point Renoir's art was infused with a personal and artistic history. Born in 1841, as a young man, he worked in a porcelain factory, drawing designs on fine china and ornamental artwork, and frequented the Louvre, where he studied the works of master painters. He became famous in 1874 as one of the French Impressionists, who bucked convention with works of quick brushstrokes of color to capture fleeting impressions. But by the early 80s, says Joe Rischel, Renoir started to question this way of painting after he went to Italy for the first time.
And he sees Raphael in Rome, the great, stately, for all ages, standing, solid figures, beautifully drawn, and he looks at fresco paintings and really has a kind of life crisis, a midlife crisis.
He rediscovered drawing and made classical style paintings with very precise outlines, an example of which is his 1887 work, The Large Bathers, part of the Philadelphia Museum of Art's permanent collection. Renoir, says Timothy Rubb, like many successful artists as they age, wanted to leave a lasting legacy.
He wanted to create an art that he felt that would be enduring, that wouldn't be transitory, that would really be about as much about a relationship with the history of art with the past as it was with his own time. And so it's not surprising to find classical subjects entering into his work.
In 1890, when Renoir was nearly 50 years old, he married Aline Charigot, the mother of his 5-year-old son, with whom he later had 2 more children. When he was in his mid-60s, he bought a house in the south of France. But his embracing of family life was not retirement, nor did he let his rheumatoid arthritis get in the way of his work. But his art took on a new look.
He comes through this remarkable synthesis of this deep saturation in Mediterranean antiquities, with mythology, the celebration of the human nude, while regaining some of the sort of blithe spirit, everything loosens up. And this carries him for the last, 29 years of his life, into a high energy phase.
In work that was both classical and experimental, personal and universal, Renoir used as subjects his friends, family, and the world around him. And his use of color, always distinctive, developed even further.
His brushwork, his handling of colors, choice of colors, and the way they are mixed together become even more sophisticated, subtle, and complex. The interweaving of colors and the skill of the brushwork, they feel like tapestries. Nobody painted like Renoir did in that respect.
He is so in love with color, so in love with looking at flesh and the way of painting flesh. And he just seems to get the paint thinner and thinner, that it will run from just the slightest little glaze with a highlight of white and then down again with a kind of lucidity and a transparency that is just one of the most sensual things in the world.
Throughout his life, he kept working, despite ailments and rumors that he could no longer paint.
And so he'd fire back by painting these enormous canvases, I mean, just basically life-size canvases, which were extraordinary when you think that he is, in fact, confined to a wheelchair. And he had this special sort of trestle system built up so that his wheelchair could be sort of raised or lowered so that he could work on the canvas.
The exhibition includes sculpture, which Renoir took up in 1907 at the age of 66. He later worked with sculptor Richard Guino, when his frailty prevented him from physically molding the clay himself. His wife died in 1915 after visiting a son injured in World War I. Curator Jennifer Thompson says when faced with calamity, Renoir turned to his art.
Matisse asked Renoir at one point, "Why do you keep pushing yourself to paint every day? You're obviously in incredible pain." And Renoir responded to Matisse. He said, "The pain passes, but the beauty remains."
At the end of the exhibition is Renoir's last painting. The Bathers is a large work depicting nude women lounging in the Mediterranean outdoors. Matisse watched him paint it and proclaimed it to be Renoir's masterpiece and one of the most beautiful pictures ever painted. Classic-looking, full-bodied figures looking perfectly relaxed in what could be an impressionist landscape. Multiple colors applied in a variety of brush styles invite looking and defy categorization. Perhaps this work makes the case most strongly that Renoir's genius continued to the end.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Late Renoir at the Philadelphia Museum of Art runs through September 6th. Philadelphia has been a printmaking pioneer since its days as the workshop of the world. Now WRTI's Tom Keels takes us to Philadelphia on Stone, an exhibition at the Library Company of Philadelphia exploring the city's early lithography.
In the early 19th century, Philadelphia was both the creative and scientific capital of America, home to artists like Charles Wilson Peale and engineers like Benjamin Henry Latrobe. Art and science merged in 1819, when a local painter created the first lithographic print in the United States, says Erica Piola, assistant curator of prints and photographs at the Library Company of Philadelphia.
Lithography is a first associated with Philadelphia, with Bass Otis, who was a portrait artist in Philadelphia. He created the first American lithograph in 1819. The actual process was discovered circa 1798 in Bavaria, but Philadelphia was the first city where an actual lithograph was produced in America.
Initially, the appeal of the new printing process was limited to painters and scientists who used it to reproduce artwork or technical illustrations. The first commercial lithographer did not open his doors in Philadelphia until 1828, but the new technique quickly revolutionized the city's printing industry. Lithography was faster and cheaper than engraving, a laborious process which involved carving images onto a metal or wooden surface.
It's a planographic printing process. You're writing with a special crayon or special ink on a stone. And because of that, it allowed for larger print runs than engraving. A copper plate or a wood block would start to wear down. So with lithograph, you'd get thousands of impressions from the same stone, which wasn't really possible with a copper plate or a wood block.
In an exhibition called Philadelphia on Stone, the first 50 years of commercial lithography in Philadelphia, 1828 to 1878, the Library Company of Philadelphia is exploring how local lithographers have depicted their city. Linda Wisniewski, print department assistant at the Library Company, believes that the prints on display document Philadelphia's evolution into a great industrial and mercantile metropolis during this time.
But it's also pride in the city, too, in these new buildings going up and the booming industry. It does say a lot about Philadelphia's pride, and I don't know that you hear that so much anymore. We were a city comparable to New York, and I think that kind of shows as well.
Lithography became the primary advertising medium of the age, especially after the introduction of chromolithography, or colored lithographs, in the 1850s. Erica Piola says these advertisements usually showed a business's physical location rather than what it produced or sold.
And at that time, you're not really showing any products so much. You showed the business where you could get the product.
For instance, the lithograph for the McCalla Hat and Cap Manufactory at 252 Market Street shows little headgear. The focus is on the workers and customers thronging the three-story brick building, its inventory-packed storeroom, and the boxes waiting to be loaded on the horse-drawn wagon parked out front. Jeffrey Ray, senior curator at the Atwater Kent Museum, sees these lithographs as going beyond promoting individual businesses to celebrate the dynamic new city.
Philadelphia was very much in the midst of the change of the American economy from agricultural to manufacturing and commercial. The images that you see of the city are of a vital city with the streets with people on them, with the sidewalks with people there, and of really active commercial interest going on.
And Philadelphia's artistic heritage gave its lithographs a unique aesthetic quality, despite their commercial nature.
There was a genuine effort to create these images that had clouds that looked like real clouds in them, that the streets looked like real streets. It has produced a visual record of the city that I don't think is equal to any other American city.
The exhibition, Philadelphia on Stone, delves into diaries and personal records to uncover what daily life was like for 19th century lithographers. While a few entrepreneurs like P.S. Duval prospered, most journeyman printers struggled to survive financially. Among them was Morris Trobel, whose story was pieced together by Linda Wisniewski from documents in the Library of Congress.
And he operated a shop in Philadelphia. You know, we discovered that he had committed suicide in 1898, I believe, and the papers talked about his financial troubles quite frequently, how he had to rely on his son, and how he had to constantly borrow money. But you get that sense in the papers that it was a financially difficult trade, but it's one that he stuck with.
Commercial lithography reached its peak during the 1876 centennial, when thousands of prints celebrated Philadelphia's magnificent World's Fair. But by 1900, advertisers had turned to photographs and line drawings, relegating lithography to its original role as an artistic medium. Erica Piola included works by two contemporary printmakers, Kip Deeds and Roberta Delaney, in the exhibit to show the continuing influence of lithography on the graphic arts.
19th century lithography in Philadelphia still has an influence on 21st century. For instance, Kip Deeds, he uses historical themes in his lithographs. And Roberta Delaney, you can sort of see in the work that's going to be in the exhibit, the framing techniques that she used are similar to framing techniques that they used in 19th century lithography.
For Piola, the heart of the exhibition consists of its early commercial lithographs, which recreate the colorful yet chaotic vitality of 19th century Philadelphia.
There's still a charm to the lithographs of the 19th century and the Philadelphia work. And, you know, I hope that also is coming out through the exhibition, that sometimes it is this kind of garish coloring, but I kind of still appreciate the garish coloring. I don't mind their grittiness or crudeness because I think that's sort of Philadelphia in its own way.
Philadelphia on Stone is the most visible element of a multi-stage enterprise spearheaded by the Library Company in partnership with other archival institutions. Plans are underway for an online catalog of more than 800 prints of the city, an illustrated biographical dictionary of early lithographers, and a collection of essays. Together, these projects will demonstrate how commercial lithography painted an indelible portrait of Philadelphia during its heyday as the workshop of the world.
WRTI's Tom Keels. Philadelphia on Stone, the first 50 years of commercial lithography in Philadelphia, 1828 to 1878, is at the Library Company of Philadelphia at 1314 Locust Street through October 15th. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester and performed by Symphony and Sea under its music director, Rossin Milanoff. The program's production associate is Eric Brannan. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter. Thanks for listening.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.